2010. It's the 50th anniversary of Jack London State Park in Glen Ellen. Like many of the state parks throughout California, Jack London relies on its volunteers and docents to bring us a rich experience when we're visiting the park. To honor all of those volunteers and to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Jack London State Park, KRCB and A Novel Idea brings you an encore presentation of Jonah Raskin and Rosemary Manchester in conversation about Jack London. Stay tuned.
Welcome to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. This evening, we're going to talk about Jack London, his life and work, and we'll focus on his book, White Fang. My guest in the studio is Jonah Raskin. Jonah chairs the Department of Communications at Sonoma State University. He's the author of several books, most recently, the biography of Allen Ginsberg. The book is called American Scream, Allen Ginsberg's Howl and the Making of the Beat Generation. And it's available in independent bookstores everywhere.
I believe it's every place, yeah.
Yes, as well as in the public library.
Yep.
Right.
Good place.
Yes. And one of my favorite books by Jonah is the anthology Natives, Newcomers, Exiles, Fugitives, Northern California Writers and Their Work. That is such a nice collection that you put together.
Oh, thank you.
And may I ask what you're working on now?
Jack London.
Oh, Jack London.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And what are you doing?
Right now I'm doing an anthology of Jack London's fiction and nonfiction about war, revolution, race, and class. He wrote a lot about those subjects. Yes.
Have you always been interested in Jack London?
No, I haven't. The first Jack London book that I ever read was The Iron Heel, and that's a futuristic novel that was published soon after White Fang, and that is about the coming of a dictatorship to the United States.
Oh, my goodness.
The Iron Heel, that's the name that he gives to the dictatorship. It's a book that describes the civil war in the United States in which the good guys, London's good guys, are defeated by the bad guys, and they have this repressive regime that lasts for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Well, that's depressing.
But there's a happy ending. 700 years go by, and then there's this utopian society that comes into existence.
Oh, I'm glad to know there's a happy ending. My goodness. But that was written 100 years ago.
Yes. So.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Do you have a favorite Jack London book?
Could be Martin Eden. There's a lot of his books that I like. Martin Eden is a novel. It's about a young man whose name is Martin Eden, and he's a sailor, and it begins with him coming back from sailing, and he gets introduced to these middle-class people in Oakland, and he feels really out of place. He's never been in a home where people have had books, and he falls in love with this young woman. He falls in love with her books, and he wants to become a writer, and he doesn't really get any support. He goes it alone. So it's partially based on London's own experiences becoming a writer in the 1890s. He felt like he had to fight tooth and nail in order to become a writer and to be published. And he just worked and worked and worked at it for years and years and years. And he had his first success in the last year of the 19th century, 1899. It was published in a magazine that Bret Harte founded in San Francisco called the Overland Monthly. He had about half a dozen stories that were published in the Overland Monthly. And then he had a book, a collection of all the stories that was called The Son of the Wolf. From the start of his writing career, he was very interested in wolves and in the wild and in dogs, and he continued that interest throughout his whole life.
Yes, and one of the things that I want to ask you about today is the extent to which the wolf and the wild dog reflects his own philosophy and his own outlook, because it seemed to me, both in Call of the Wild and White Fang, that it was more than a story about a wild dog.
Yes.
Yes.
So I suppose you could read both of them autobiographically. You could see the ways that both novels reflect Jack London's evolution or devolution. He found the wild very appealing. He certainly had part of his life in which he was a real wild man. Buck, the dog in The Call of the Wild, starts off in California in very comfortable surroundings, and he gets kidnapped and sent off to the Klondike, and he ends up in the wild. And then in White Fang, we have the reverse. We have a dog who starts off in the wilds and comes to California and becomes domesticated. So Jack London found both the wild appealing and domestication appealing also. He did like the creature comforts.
Yes. Do you think he considered himself an outsider most of his life?
Yes, that certainly comes across in White Fang. White Fang is a loner, an outcast, an outsider, and London definitely felt that way. He felt at times that he was a leper. He felt like he had no family. He didn't belong. Yes, an outsider. Also, as a Californian, in some ways, that also contributed to his feeling of being an outsider, certainly in the world of writers. His publishers were in New York, 3,000 miles away, in the days before airplanes and computers and email and faxing. That was considerable distance.
In the days, even as automobiles were a rarity.
In his early days, when he was struggling to be a writer, he got around on a bicycle, and he just rode his bicycle everywhere. So Martin Eden, now I don't think, I was saying that is one of my favorites of all of his books. And, you know, James Joyce has a book called The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Martin Eden is a portrait of an artist as a young man. It describes this writer, Martin Eden, and how he makes his way and how he becomes successful and famous and wealthy. And as soon as he becomes successful and wealthy and famous, all of the people who didn't want to have anything to do with him suddenly invite him to his home. And the character is so disillusioned by that because they don't seem to like him for who he is, but all these trappings of success, all these external things, but not his own innate being.
It sounds as though that book should be a candidate for the great American novel. It seems to have all the elements that we look for in the books Great Gatsby and Grapes of Wrath and
yes.
Books that are often mentioned.
I would agree.
I don't think I've seen Martin Eden on those lists.
I don't think it has made it to the lists of great American novels. It's also a really, really good love story between Martin and this young woman named Ruth, who he falls in love with. And he didn't just write dog stories. He could also do a really great job, I think so anyway, in looking at this relationship between a young man and a young woman. The nuances of courtship and distances between them because of their origins and the ways that they come together and become a couple and then drift apart. And for a long time, you don't know how it's going to end up. And it was serialized in a magazine called the Pacific Monthly. And I would think that the readers would not have known month to month when that book was serialized how it was going to turn out. And the ending, I don't want to say what the ending is, but the ending is just one of the most powerful endings in all of American literature.
Well, I'm going to make it a point to read Martin Eden by Jack London, because, you know, I respect your evaluation of books, and that's certainly you're giving it an A, so I'm going to read it.
I'm giving it an A, yes.
All right, and everyone out there, the name of that book is Martin Eden.
It's in paperback, too.
In paperback, okay. His work is enormously popular all over the world. He's translated into so many languages, and I feel that the literary critics have been slow to claim him as one of the great American writers.
Jack London probably contributed to his not being as lionized as some of us would like him to be lionized. And that is that he definitely had a big mouth, and he was definitely opening his mouth and had all kinds of opinions, and very strong opinions, and opinions that would offend just about anybody. In 1905 and 1906, he traveled around the country in which he spoke on college campuses from Berkeley. The president of UC Berkeley invited him to speak. He spoke at Berkeley. He spoke on campuses all across the country. He was at Harvard. He was at Yale. He was urging college students to take to the barricades and to have a revolution. He even endorsed assassinations of people. So that's pretty radical.
That's pretty far out.
Yes.
Right?
So yes. There might be some people who say, well, I don't want to endorse a writer who defended assassination, or some people feel uncomfortable when I describe Jack London as a racist, but I feel yes. comfortable saying, yeah, Jack London was a racist at times. He really yes. thought that white people were superior to everybody else.
You see that in his writing. I mean, I haven't read many of his books, but I picked that up right away. So dismissive of Indians and
yes.
of black people.
I just finished reading his essay, The Yellow Peril. It's about how the United States and Americans should watch out for the Japanese, that the Japanese were going to take over. In one way, he did admire the Japanese military. He thought Japanese soldiers were very efficient, very disciplined. But he also said that the Japanese had no ethical sense, no moral sense whatsoever. Mm. Well, that may mm-hmm. prejudice some people mm-hmm. against Jack London.
Although it is interesting that he probably reflects the thinking of his day. Not that we're all past that racism now, but it might have been more blatant and more socially acceptable in those days to put down people of other races.
Yes, he does reflect those times, though it's also true that not everybody was a racist at that time. Jack London joined the Socialist Party in 1896 when he was 20 years old, and he stayed in the Socialist Party for the next 20 years of his life, which was his entire life. So as a socialist, one of the things that he learned from socialism was to respect people from other races and other cultures. So you find him at the height of his socialist embrace of socialist ideas, you find him saying very nice things about the Japanese. The only thing that was consistent about him was that he kept changing and reinventing himself. He didn't remain fixed. He was always in flux. He was always changing. Continual evolution. He was very interested in Darwin's ideas. So maybe to also inch our way to White Fang, I mean, White Fang is the story about a dog who goes through a series of evolutions. He continually changes, and he ends up being opposite of where he started out from.
Yes.
And that is also a reflection of Jack London. The book is about this, the journey. It's a novel, The Education of a Young Dog.
Yes, yes. And he wrote this book 100 years ago.
Well, he wrote it in 1904 and 1905, and then it was published in 1906.
Published 100 years ago.
And those were the times when he was publishing usually 3 books a year. So he had this ability to have part of his brain in a dog story and another part of his brain in a love story and another part of his brain writing about his experiences as a hobo and a tramp and being able to do all of that at the same time.
And his protagonist, White Fang, is, I imagine our listeners have already picked up, is a wild dog. The offspring of a wolf and a somewhat domesticated dog.
I would say that he's largely wolf.
Largely wolf.
Yes, okay. He has some ancestor, some dog in there someplace.
Uh-huh.
I believe on his father's side.
Yeah. And Jack London gets right inside the mind of White Fang and does a great deal of what people now call anthropomorphism, in that he gives a human characteristics to the dog, and yet it seems to work.
Yes, I think it does. Well, I'd say that we've also come to see dogs as very intelligent species, and
true.
And dogs do seem, I know some people who certainly feel like dogs do some kind of, well, do we call it thinking? There's something that's going on in there.
Yes.
And dogs have feelings. Mm-hmm. They seem like they can express their feelings.
Yes.
So in the beginning of White Fang, Jack London introduces us to White Fang's parents. So it's really important he wants the readers to know where White Fang comes from, his origins.
Oh.
So what he's getting from heredity, what he's inheriting, what he's getting from his parents. And so there's some of that wildness or ferocity that he's getting from his parents. And then also what he's getting from the environment that he's growing up in, and the harshness of that environment.
Particularly interesting when Jack London didn't know who his own biological father was.
He was never certain who his biological father was.
But he must have thought about it a good deal, wondered about
it. His daughter, Joan, thought that he was haunted by that his whole life, of who his parents were. He knew who his mother was, but he never really knew absolutely positively who his father was. He had some ideas. He wrote to the man who he thought was his father, William Henry Cheney, in 1897. And Mr. Cheney wrote back and said, "I'm sorry, I empathize with you. I can imagine how you feel, but I am not your father." So, and he said some really harsh things about Jack's mother. It must have really been hard to take.
Jack London was a very, very close observer of dogs and of wild dogs. I guess he had a lot of time to observe them when he was up in the Yukon.
Yes, he was doing a lot of observing. He was keeping a journal a lot of the time. His journal of in the Klondike is just fascinating. What he saw and what he heard, descriptions of nature. He had never been in a place in which there was just so much wildlife, in which he also had a lot of contact with Native Americans and described them. And he was also doing a lot of listening to people who were telling stories and learning about storytelling, too, when he was in the Klondike. And so when he came back, he got scurvy when he was away. And so he came back, well, earlier than he thought he would come back. And he began to write, and he started to write a lot of stories that were inspired by his time in the Klondike, writing about just the magnitude of the place, the whiteness and the silence, and a lot about his stories about the Klondike are a lot about death that happened to people there. The frontier, it's a description of life on the frontier.
Oh.
So in that sense, it's a continuation of James Fenimore Cooper's Leather Stocking Tales, which he'd read and which he knew about. And the American frontier had been declared closed in 1890. And then so Jack London's stories were coming out at the end of the 1890s. And here he was showing the frontier was still around. Americans had known the frontier since the beginning of America. And writers had been writing about the frontier. So he was very much in that tradition of Americans who were looking at the frontier and what happened there.
Mm-hmm. And the vicissitudes of life there as they formed the character of the people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that he was interested in both heredity and the environment. And I found it fascinating the way he felt the dog's character was shaped by the reaction, first of all, of the other dogs toward him, the fact that the other dogs bullied him.
Are you talking about when he comes into civilization?
No, early on, in some of the early stories about White Fang, there was one older dog in particular who gave him a very hard time. And then the other dogs used to all pile on him. And I remember his word for the character of White Fang at this point was that it made him morose as well as ferocious.
Right.
And I wondered if Jack London himself ever felt bullied and felt morose.
Definitely felt morose, solitary, isolated. He often said that he had the blues, and he had long periods of time when he was depressed. Today, he'd probably be, if he went to a therapist, he'd probably be diagnosed as bipolar.
Yes.
He had these really big mood swings. He was very energetic and upbeat, enthusiastic, and he could also be really very, very down.
And White Fang then encounters man, first of all, in a Native American village where he's not well treated. But then it gets even worse And he has this very, very bad master, a white man whose name, oddly enough, is Beauty Smith.
Right.
And a terrible character. And, of course, he's brutal to White Fang.
Yes, they're kind of suited for one another. Beauty Smith has the same kind of, well, he's mad. He's sadistic. There isn't really any warmth or humanity about Beauty Smith. And so he and White Fang kind of feed off of one another and build each other's ferocity.
Yes.
And, yeah. I like the early part of the book where, well, White Fang, he's growing up in a cave, and it takes a while before he ventures out of this immediate environment that he's grown up in and goes out into the world and explores the world and sees what the world is like. And he learns to be crafty and to be sly and to be a trickster. And I think that Jack London was also using some of his own experiences as a young boy to create White Fang's character.
And he was quite lyrical in his description of the cave. I found it fascinating that he had White Fang looking at what he thought was a wall of light that was actually the door of the cave.
Right.
And that's really quite an amazing figure of speech.
Yes, he is poetic there.
Yes.
I do think, though, that there's a basic difference between The Call of the Wild and White Fang. I think that when Jack London wrote The Call of the Wild, he did not know how it was going to end, that he started to write, and he thought it was just going to be a short story. But as he wrote, it got out of hand. It got longer and bigger and more complex, mm-hmm. and he was carried away. Jack London thought that the best writing should come from the unconscious or the subconscious. And in The Call of the Wild, he definitely got in touch with his own unconscious and subconscious. Whereas in White Fang, he knew exactly what was going to happen at the end of the story when he started to write the story. He knew that it was going to end in civilization with domesticity, with this wild dog, this wolf, living in a house and having masters. So knowing that was the ending, you can see that it's very carefully structured and very carefully plotted. It has symmetry about it.
Yes.
It has a very clear beginning and middle and end.
Yes. Jack London presented the point of view of White Fang that the people in his life were gods. He did that with a small g, but he always spoke of them as the gods. And then when White Fang just barely in time was rescued from death by the good master, Whedon Scott, Jack London calls him the love master.
Right.
Which is a very interesting term.
So there probably, yes, London is also thinking about his own discovery of love and what love meant. And in his own early years, I don't think that he really understood or experienced love. He certainly didn't feel it from his own mother. He never felt mother love, and he didn't really feel love from his stepfather, who always looked at him, inhospitably, to say the least, because he wasn't his own son. Here he was, another man's child who was living there. And so growing up in his own family, he didn't really have a sense of love. I guess his first love was he did describe it as puppy love. Then he fell in love quite a bit. once he discovered love, the feeling of love, Jack London, he loved that kind of intoxication that you get when you're in love.
Oh.
Yes.
And we see in the resolution that he arranged for White Fang, the resolution that he probably wanted in his own life. Once White Fang was with the good master, with the love master, it was arranged that he went with his new master back to civilization. And he was not happy at all in the city, but they moved quickly through San Francisco and went to this idyllic place in the country where White Fang lived out the rest of his life very happily and very comfortably, devoted always to his master. He tolerated the rest of the family, but his devotion was for the love master.
Yes. Jack London, he could be a very wild fellow, but he certainly was a very hard worker.
Yes.
And you could say that in all of his dog stories, or most of his dog stories, the dogs are put into harness, and they're pulling great weight. So he also saw himself as a man who was in harness, that he was pulling a great weight. He didn't like the idea of having a master, really, of somebody over him. Jack London didn't. But on a sort of abstract kind of level of, well, mastery. He liked mastering a subject and being the master of his own environment. Mm-hmm. He did really think of things that were larger than life, mm-hmm. of accepting a kind of mastery of the universe, mm-hmm. really, yeah.
And it seemed to me that the resolution that he gave White Fang in this idyllic place in the country was very similar to the idyllic retreat that he planned for himself and for Charmian, his wife, when they moved up into the Valley of the Moon and had Beauty Ranch and began to build their dream house.
Yeah, so he was writing White Fang about the same time that he was moving from Oakland to Sonoma County and to living in Glen Ellen and buying the land and feeling happy about getting away from urban environment and from crowds of people, yes. But he didn't stay in Glen Ellen.
No.
He always had wanderlust. He always wanted to travel, and even after he bought the land and then started to build Wolf House, many, many rooms, huge mansion, he and Charmian continued to travel all around the United States and all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was the place that they came back to, their refuge, and the place where they were, well, not exactly alone together, but with a smaller group of people than what they usually
travel. Well, they were entertaining quite a lot, yes.
Yes, and then, of course, they had a staff of people to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Jonah Raskin, and we're discussing the life and work of Jack London. Jonah and I made a field trip up to Jack London State Park, and we spent several hours in the House of Happy Walls and looking at the ruins of Wolf House. And we took a tape recorder with us, and we're going to play for you some of the soundtrack from that expedition up at Jack London State Park. I am embarrassed to say that it was my first trip to Jack London State Park, and I've known about it forever, but I'd never gotten myself up there. So I want to encourage our listeners to go up to Jack London State Park. It's very easy to get to. You go to Glen Ellen, and you turn on Jack London Drive, and you end up in the parking lot.
Well, Rosemary, we talked to the warden. Is that what he's called?
Or? Yes.
He said that there were a lot of local people had no idea that it existed, There are people from all over the world who go there.
That's right.
So, and he was saying a lot of people from Russia, and Jack London has been more popular in the last 100 years in Russia than he's been in the United States. Yeah. I think there's something universal. Obviously, there's something universal about both Call of the Wild and White Fang. They're books that travel well, and they're books that translate well. And obviously, they have been and they are appreciated by people in lots of different cultures and lots of different societies, that the arc of the experience of moving from the wild into domesticity and the stages. I think that people can identify with White Fang, both in his ferocity and the ways that he's antisocial, and then the ways that he becomes socialized, the way he's a loner, and the negative. He has a lot of negative aspects of his personality, but they do help him survive, and in the ways that he's able to change. So I would say that in White Fang, London is probably at his most optimistic. If you take somebody from one environment, a harsh environment, well, in a harsh environment, cruel, competitive, a person is probably, or a dog, is probably going to be harsh, competitive, mean. But if you take that same dog or human being and you create a different environment that's kind, that's loving, in which there's generosity, that same preacher is going to reflect the warmth and generosity of that environment. So London had that idea, which is why he was a socialist. He thought if we could create this positive society in which people are not fighting one another to survive, in which there's abundance of things and goods and people get what they need, that the meanness that people show is not going to be there. He had that. At the same time, there was a part of him that thought there was some innate quality about a kind of savagery or barbarity or ferocity that you could never really get rid of. So that at the very end of White Fang, even though White Fang, here he is, he's living, well, in a very comfortable place, and there's a convict who's escaped from San Quentin and breaks in to the house of the judge, and White Fang, he reverts to the ways of the wild, and he attacks the man who breaks in and protects the family. So I think that London thought there was something, he saw something in people, even in very civilized circumstances, that a kind of basic instinct, shall we call it, that all kinds of modern technology didn't get rid of.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Jonah Raskin, and we're talking about Jack London, his life and work, and specifically his book, White Fang. We'll be right back.
God remained quiet, made no movement, and White Fang's snarl slowly dwindled to a growl that ebbed down in his throat and ceased. Then the God spoke, and at the first sound of his voice, the hair rose on White Fang's neck, and the growl rushed up in his throat. But the God made no hostile movement and went on calmly talking. For a time, White Fang growled in unison with him, a correspondence of rhythm being established between growl and voice. But the God talked on interminably. He talked to White Fang as White Fang had never been talked to before. He talked softly and soothingly, with a gentleness that somehow, somewhere touched White Fang. In spite of himself, White Fang began to have confidence in this God. He had a feeling of security that was belied by all of his experience with men. There it came now, the God's hand, cunning to hurt, thrusting out at him, descending upon his head. But the God went on talking. His voice was soft and soothing. In spite of the menacing hand, the voice inspired confidence. And in spite of the assuring voice, the hand inspired distrust. White Fang was torn by conflicting feelings, impulses. It seemed he would fly to pieces, so terrible was the control he was exerting, holding together by an unwanted indecision the counter forces that struggled within him for mastery. He compromised. He snarled and bristled and flattened his ears, but he neither snapped nor sprang away. The hand descended. Nearer and nearer it came. It touched the ends of his upstanding hair. He shrank down under it. It followed down after him, pressing more closely against him. Shrinking, almost shivering, he still managed to hold himself together. It was torment, this hand that touched him and violated his instinct. He could not forget in a day all the evil that had been wrought him at the hands of men, but it was the will of God, and he strove to submit. The hand lifted and descended again in a patting, caressing movement. This continued, but every time the hand lifted, the hair lifted under it. And every time the hand descended, the ears flattened down, and a cavernous growl surged in his voice. White Fang growled and growled with insistent warning. By this means, he announced that he was prepared to retaliate for any hurt he might receive. There was no telling when the god's ulterior motive might be disclosed. At any moment, that soft, confidence-inspiring voice might break forth in a roar of wrath, that gentle and caressing hand transform itself into a vice-like grip to hold him helpless and administer punishment. But the god talked on softly, and ever the hand rose and fell with non-hostile pats. White Fang experienced dual feelings. It was distasteful to his instinct. It restrained him, opposed the will of him toward personal liberty, and yet it was not physically painful. On the contrary, it was even pleasant in a physical way. It was the beginning of the end for White Fang, the ending of the old life and the reign of hate. A new and incomprehensibly fair life was dawning. It required much thinking and endless patience on the part of Whedon Scott to accomplish this. And on the part of White Fang, it required nothing less than a revolution. He had to ignore the urges and promptings of instinct and reason, defy experience, give the lie to life itself. In short, when all things were considered, he had to achieve an orientation far vaster than the one he had achieved at the time he came voluntarily in from the wild.
You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Jonah Raskin, and we're talking about Jack London, his life and work, and specifically his book, White Fang. I found, as I read the book, that my heart was with White Fang through the whole book. And it was true that there were times when he behaved badly. But I had the feeling that he was going to overcome all obstacles. And I never gave up on the character of White Fang or turned against him, you know, as you do in some books when the protagonist behaves badly. I was with him the whole way. And I give credit to Jack London in his writing that he knew how to bring the reader along and to let us know that White Fang would prevail,
yes,
that there were terrible obstacles to overcome, but that he would do it.
And yes.
To me, it was heroic.
I know lots of people who say, oh, when I was 10 or 11 or 12, I read White Fang, and it just inspired me. Or recently I met a group of French people, and they wanted to know what I was doing and what I was writing, and I said I was writing about Jack London, and somebody said, White Fang. People do know this book,
yes,
and they know it in many different parts of the world.
Yes. There seems to be kind of a surge of interest in Jack London just now. Books being written.
Yes.
And there's an opera. That's exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really eager to see it. Now, the opera is based on Jack London's memoir that's called John Barleycorn. So one thing that we have not mentioned so far is that Jack London, well, I would say that he was an alcoholic.
We haven't talked about his drinking problem.
People say, well, he just didn't like to drink now and then. Well, but his drinking did affect his health, and he damaged his kidneys irreparably. He died at the age of 40. I would say he did abuse alcohol.
Yes.
I heard recently about a man who wants to rebuild Wolf House.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's that. Over the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a number of Jack London books that have been republished. I think it all began really with the 100th anniversary of Call of the Wild, which was in 2003.
Yes, and you and I talked about that on this program.
Realizing how many-faceted he was, yes, multifaceted he was. And yes, in a little over 16 years, he wrote 50 books. You know, it's sort of like the parable of the blind man and the elephant, and in some ways Jack London is like that. He's got so many different aspects of him. His stories about the Klondike, the stories about the South Seas, his memoirs, books about boxing. He wrote a lot about boxing. Mm. He was a sports reporter. He covered the Mexican Revolution, the U.S. military invasion of Mexico in 1914. He covered the Russian-Japanese War. He wrote a lot about California. He's one of California's foremost writers. He did a lot of different things.
Let's hear some of the recording that Jonah and I made at Jack London State Park at the House of Happy Walls, where the museum is.
We're in the House of Happy Walls, which was built by Charmaine London in 1919, after 3 years after Jack London died. And we're at the case looking at the blueprints and photos and sketches of Wolf House that burned down in 1913. And so, but I think you get from being inside this room, you get a sense of Jack and Charmaine, their style. Like, it's a big room.
Yes, it is.
And it's roomy. It has it's got a lot of wood in it. It has these big windows. It has window seats. They were both people who thought on a big scale.
I love the alcoves with the curtains that you could draw across and those very, very comfortable window seats. And you can just imagine the two of them tucked up in there reading books.
Yeah, exactly. It looks very inviting, very comfortable. Well, Wolf House was really very carefully planned for the two of them, for a place for Jack to work. There was a place for Charmaine's Steinway piano. They didn't move into Wolf House because it burned down, but they lived in a place called Wake Robin Lodge. And they also lived in the cottage that's on the across the way from here. And they did a lot of entertaining, and there was always people, or there were lots of visitors. Uh-huh. And
you remarked about the scale of the house, that it was big. Were they big people physically?
No, they actually weren't that big. Uh-huh. Jack London was like 5'8", tall, about 180 pounds.
Uh-huh. And Charmaine?
Charmaine was, I don't know her exact measurements, but she wasn't as tall as Jack. Uh-huh. You know, she was kind of, I would call her slight, uh-huh. You know.
So. Well, there's some pictures of them I've just been looking at, and they certainly had style.
To me, he looks contemporary. You know, there's a lot of people.
He does, doesn't he? I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what it is, but there's some pictures you look at people from the late 19th or the very early 20th century, and they look like they're from back then, whereas Jack London looks like if he walked into the room.
Yes.
Like with the way his hair is kind of tousled a little bit, right. And he's wearing that very fashionable black leather jacket.
He
looks cool.
Yeah, he looks cool. And Charmaine as well. I was just looking at a picture of the two of them on their boat, the Snark.
Yes.
And it could be, as you say, it could be a contemporary picture.
Yeah.
Whoops. There's the Charmaine lounging.
There they are in their Snark. Okay, uh-huh. Yes, yeah. So...
all dressed up.
In Samoa from 1908. So, yes, Jack and Charmaine were planning, and there's also a picture of the Snark with the sails and the American flag. They were planning to sail around the world, and then Jack got ill early on, and they came back.
Oh.
But he wanted to go completely around the world. He wanted to sail up the Seine River and more between the Notre Dame. He wanted to put his boat up there, and then just to walk around Paris. He had a lot of great ideas. So
was he a good sailor?
Yes, he was a good sailor. He learned to sail pretty early on in life. In by the time he was like 15 or 16, he could sail.
Uh-huh.
He was sailing in San Francisco Bay.
Yeah.
And then in 1893, he went out on a schooner all the way from San Francisco to Asia, to Japan, and throughout the seas there on this hunting seal.
Uh-huh.
And so he did. He learned early on how to sail. Uh-huh. Yes. So.
I notice here in the case is the medicine kit from the Snark, and it's not very big, and it doesn't look as though it could handle anything too serious. Perhaps that's why when he was ill, they had to come back.
Yes, they went to a hospital in Australia and took care of Jack. And but he had a terrible medical history. He was always suffering from some kind of disease, illness. always seeing doctors, I mean, continually. He had this, I mean, there's this image. He liked this image of being physically fit, and he was known as a physical culturalist. Remember that phrase?
Oh, yes, I remember that, yes.
Or he was frequently working out and running and rowing and swimming, but no end of medical problems.
But somehow doesn't that complement his stature as a heroic character, because he overcomes the physical weakness and doesn't allow it to interfere with what he wants to do. And it's almost the classic hero who is flawed in some way and yet triumphs over it.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. Yeah, so I think he probably thought of it that way. Yes, mm-hmm. Triumphing over adversity, yes.
Yes.
Always triumphing, either external, the environment, the harsh environment that he found himself in when he was growing up, or the sort of limitations, physical limitations. So the trait that Jack London liked the best about himself and about people in general was what he called plasticity. So the ability to adapt to different circumstances, to mold yourself, I mean, to go from land to sea, to go from San Francisco or Oakland to Sonoma County, from urban to rural, or to the South Seas, or when he went to London to write about people living in the slums, to adapt to that environment. Mm-hmm. I guess I like that concept of plasticity, of being very adaptable. Uh-huh. Adaptability. Yeah. Is, I think that's a really good strength.
And he certainly didn't limit himself to one school of thought or one lifestyle. He started out very poor and then worked so hard to establish himself and worked so hard at his writing.
Yes, absolutely. He was definitely a hard worker. He set himself the goal of writing 1,000 words a day. So he'd usually get up and he'd write. He didn't do very much rewriting. You can see the manuscripts. Well, from the time he married Charmian, mm-hmm. he would handwrite, and then he would give her the handwritten manuscript, and she would type it up. So she was, in a lot of ways, really indispensable to him.
Where would we go to see them? Or are they in museums, in research libraries?
Yes. His manuscripts are, a lot of his manuscripts are in Pasadena at the Huntington Library in Pasadena. I have some photocopies of his manuscripts. And his handwriting is pretty easy to read. I can read it pretty easily. So here, there's a picture we're looking at here, a picture of Jack and Charmian on the Snark. So Jack was also, he took thousands of books with him on the Snark. And he wrote while he was on the Snark.
Yeah.
So what he wrote, there was a book that he wrote, The Cruise of the Snark. And then he also wrote, when he was on the Snark and traveling around the Pacific, he also wrote one of his best novels, Martin Eden. Jack was also a photographer, and he took a lot of photographs, and there were also a lot of photographs taken of him and taken of Charmian. So they really documented their own lives. And Jack wrote, and Charmian also kept her journals and described what her life with Jack London. This quotation from him, the quotation from him, like, it really indicates how he felt about life, where he said, "I would rather be ashes than dust. I would rather that my spark should burn out in a brilliant blaze than it should be stifled by dry rot. I would rather be a superb meteor, every atom of me in magnificent glow, than a sleepy and permanent planet. The proper function of man is to live, not to exist. I shall not waste my days in trying to prolong them. I shall use my time." So he was burning intensely, living intensely.
Yeah.
He said he wanted a place to loaf. He was not a loafer. Mm-hmm. He was always involved in something or other. Yeah. Well, here, there's Jack's camera, his early Kodak. This case is he covered the Russian-Japanese War of 1904, and then a decade later, during the Mexican Revolution, the United States sent troops to Mexico, and he covered that war also. So he wanted to be a war correspondent. Here are some photographs of him from the time he went to cover the Russian-Japanese War.
And there's a clipping from a newspaper that says Jack London is in a Japanese prison.
Yes. He took photographs when he wasn't supposed to take photographs, and he was arrested. His camera was impounded. They seized his, confiscated his camera. So he was very frustrated about covering the Russian-Japanese War in 1904 because he wasn't allowed to go to the front. He wasn't allowed to go and interview troops. The Japanese government had real restrictions about reporters and what they could do. And then they also censored. He couldn't just wire his stories back to the San Francisco Examiner. They had to go through a censor first. So he was very frustrated about that. So this is a famous photograph here of Charmian. She has, I don't know if you can see it in this photo, she has a pistol strapped to her around her waist and her belt. And here she is standing with some indigenous peoples who are largely undressed.
Yes.
So, yes. And she has this kind of devil-may-care sort of expression on her face.
And like, a kind of a garden party hat.
Yes.
Yes. So, well, here's her piano.
Maybe this is her schoolwork.
Ah.
Yeah, so we're standing right at the Steinway. It looks like a baby Steinway to me.
I think it is a baby grand.
It's not one. Yes, okay. And so Charmian played the piano. She was a really good piano player. Don't know whether she sang or not, but on social occasions she would sit at the piano and play the piano. And these are beautiful. I don't know, what do you call these objects here?
With screens to set off a corner of the room?
Yeah, they're beautiful.
Beautiful. Tapa cloth, maybe.
And the Samoan war drum. Yeah. Fantastic. So this panel has three different sections from Jack's life: the socialist, Prince of the Oyster Pirates, the student. So the earliest one is this, the Prince of the Oyster Pirates, which to me, he kind of, I would say, Jack was a thief.
Yes.
You know, and there was also a part of his life in which he was a hoodlum.
He was like a pirate.
Yeah, but pirate kind of romanticizes it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think he romanticized himself,
yes.
Don't you think?
He had this. He had the boat called the Razzle Dazzle, and he would go out in San Francisco Bay, and he would steal oysters that people were farming commercial oyster business, and then he would sell them. So, and then he did that for a while, and then there was something called the Fish Patrol in San Francisco Bay. It was law enforcement for San Francisco Bay regulations about fishing and for salmon and shrimp. So he started off on one side of the law, and then he was on the other side. I mean, he was breaking the law, and then he went to work enforcing the law, which also seems to me representative or typical of him, that he could be on one side and then he could do the opposite.
If you could ask Jack London a question, what would you like to ask him?
There's sometimes I wonder how conscious he was about some of the things that he did or he said. I think I'd also want to know about his origins. Who did he think his father was? What difference did that make? I don't know. Sometimes I think that he did things without realizing what he was doing. And I'd like to ask him that. I would like to have a conversation with him. I wouldn't mind having a drink with him. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry that I arrived on the scene 100 years too late.
Mm-hmm. And when you go to the House of Happy Walls, you could visualize yourself sitting there in that window seat with Jack and Charmian and asking them questions and hearing about their adventures. And they must have been marvelous people to socialize with.
Well, they did have a lot of fun. They had people coming to stay with them, and they were always playing games, of all kinds of games. And Jack also did have a sense of humor. I know we've said that he was a dark person and could be really dreary. But he also was, he was very funny. He was very playful. If you look at the photographs of Jack and Charmian, they're very often mugging for the camera and clowning around. Mm-hmm. There was that aspect of this playfulness about their relationship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was there anything more that you wanted to say about White Fang? Did I move quickly by things that you would like to have talked about?
I guess I appreciate it as a tale of one wolf's revolution. London uses the word revolution, and I thought that was significant. The fact that he'd been in the thick of, at that time, in left-wing radical revolutionary politics, and that he was taking that political term and he was applying it to the personal story of this one wolf.
Perhaps that's part of the secret of the endurance of the popularity of the book, that he still speaks of revolutionary change against oppression. And, of course, that's a theme that's timeless.
Yeah, so it's a personal revolution.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Jonah, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this talk with you about Jack London and Charmian and White Fang. Sometimes it seems to be you know everything there is to know about Jack London and Charmian, and it's just a pleasure that you're so willing to share your knowledge of him.
I enjoyed the opportunity of rereading White Fang, and been a pleasure talking to you.
Yes. I want also to thank you for the trip through the Jack London State Park and all the information that you shared with us about the exhibits in the museum. And I encourage our listeners to go up to Jack London State Park, to the House of Happy Walls, and to see the ruins of Wolf House, and to visit the gravesite of Jack and Charmian. And until then, this is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, reminding you that there's no such thing as too many books.
Thanks for listening to this encore presentation of A Novel Idea here on KRCB.